Welcome to Graciously Confident, a podcast from the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. And in this short series, we're testing the Church's response and our own responses to the assisted dying legislation that's being considered in the UK and Ireland. My name is Will Leach. I'm a journalist and broadcaster, and we want these four programmes in this series to help you understand and respond. Now, the last time we looked at what palliative care is and what palliative care isn't. This time, we're going to hear from the voices we haven't heard from yet. People who know what this is like to live through. People with stories that speak. Joining us is Dr. Alwyn Mark, who's a lecturer in practical theology at Union Theological College in Belfast. Alwyn lost her father, Douglas, the Reverend Douglas Mark, to cancer after a long period of illness. Also with us is the Reverend Ian Harbinson, who retired due to his own illness and now helps and counsels many others going through a cancer experience and sometimes an end-of-life experience. Alwyn, Ian, thanks for joining us, both of you. Very welcome.
Thank you.
Ian, you haven't been well for a while. What's your story?
Yeah, while my illness is cancer, I am very conscious of many throughout Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic who suffer with other serious and long-term illnesses, MND, multiple sclerosis, degenerative disorders. And I would want to preface all that I say by sharing the understanding and compassion I have for all who suffer. My particular journey is cancer. I had never anticipated that I would have a cancer diagnosis until symptoms began grumbling in the form of back pain and then abdominal pain and then extreme tiredness. A long route thereafter followed to come to a diagnosis. A scan in my local hospital led me very quickly to the pancreatic cancer unit in Belfast. Subsequent surgery in which I lost a considerable part of my pancreas, spleen, bowel and part of my stomach. I live now on a veritable bucket of tablets daily, and chemicals even digest my food for me and control my blood sugars. One of the great fears, I guess, that is an issue, and I speak of no doubt to many who have gone through a cancer experience, is the constant awareness of, will this come back? Aware of that, I realised that I had to retire from active ministry and now spend my time supporting and upholding people on a cancer journey. I did a postgrad qualification in counselling to be qualified to help folks.
Well, we'll hear quite a bit about that in a moment. Alwyn, how did you lose your dad?
What a privilege it is to do this alongside Ian, because my dad and Ian were good friends and a good support on their journeys. Dad had cancer for 11 years and 6.5 of those were with a terminal diagnosis. And he died on the 19th of September 2016 in the Macmillan unit in Antrim Area Hospital. And just to say on that, that as a family, we were incredibly grateful for the medical support and treatment that Dad received throughout his illness. But particularly, we were grateful for the specialist palliative care that he received in his final days in the Macmillan unit and the support that we received as a family in those days. There were really precious days, really precious family moments, and the comfort and the peace and the safety that the Macmillan unit offered us as a family was something that has deeply impacted all of us. And above all, we knew that Dad was receiving the best care. And that's what was so important for us after such a long illness, to know that Dad would receive the best care, and care that would not strive to keep him alive, but care that would help him to die comfortably and peacefully.
Your father was a man who thought deeply about these things and cared deeply about these things. Of course he did. So you know this is coming, Alwyn, but he spoke about his illness and the prospect of his life ending at New Horizons in 2016. So we're going to play a tiny bit of what he said. There's a little bit of interference in this recording, and I'm sorry for that, but it is worth hearing. So here's what he said on stage when people said the strangest things to him about his diagnosis.
I don't understand that. But somehow I believe deeply, very deeply, that my cancer is part of the purposes of God for my life. It is a path which he has called me to follow. It is a path which I gladly walk on. He knows what he is doing. He is wise. He is good. He is merciful. He is gracious. He is intentional.
It was some time before you could listen to that talk, wasn't it?
Mum and Dad delivered that seminar entitled Living with Terminal Illness and with Hope just 6 weeks before Dad died. And I remember at the time I wasn't emotionally strong enough to go to be part of that seminar, but I did know that I wanted to listen to it before Dad died. And so I did get a recording, and I remember going down to Portchester Strand and listening to Mum and Dad tell their story. I think what it reflected for me was the honesty that they wanted to bring to the cancer journey, but also the deep faith that they wanted to express. And I think they journeyed Dad's illness with courage, but with deep conviction about the hope that they had in Christ. And I think they opened up through that seminar, but also just through the journey of those 11 years, the opportunity for honest conversations about the pain of suffering and death, but also the sure foundation that we have in Christ. And I think that's why they titled it the way they did, Living with Terminal Illness and with Hope. We don't grieve as those with no hope. We grieve, but we don't grieve as those with no hope. And if we have hope for this life only, as 1 Corinthians 15 says, we're the most to be pitied, but we don't. We have hope in an eternal perspective. And so we learnt as a family, as we journeyed over those years, that we hold that tension of that deep pain and grief and that eternal hope. In the latter years of Dad's pastoral ministry, Dad also worked with the persecuted church and met many Christians across the world that lived in constant fear of their own death or death of their family, and lived with suffering that we know nothing about. And so I believe that was deeply formational for Dad and for my parents and for us as a family. And in facing suffering and death for those in the persecuted church, that didn't weaken their faith, it strengthened their faith. And so I think as we raised our eyes beyond our circumstances and looked outside, that actually we're part of a global church that has an eternal hope that we really need to grasp hold of.
Everybody who's ill, Ian, has a moment of diagnosis when the doctor says, well, I have to tell you, there's this and there's that and the implications of it. What was it like for you?
I well remember the day, Will, that my wife and I were given that great privilege of meeting with he who would be my surgeon. After immediate politeness, he pulled round his PC monitor. The first time that I was going to have the opportunity to see my tumour. And I think for me it was a surreal moment. I knew all this was happening, and it somehow or other was happening at a distance. But when a surgeon circles with his coloured pen on a screen around what was my tumour, I just felt at that moment, I can't get away from this. This is now tagged to my life. I remember his immediate response was that we're going to get this out. And there's a sense of which of that brings comfort. But immediately after those words, I really don't remember anything that he said. And it's one reason why I always encourage people who are going for serious appointment visits with consultants or surgeons or whom at that level, is always take someone with you. Mm. Because in all likelihood, you will not remember a quarter of the conversation. Mm-hmm. So I was very glad that Anne, my wife, was with me.
Was there fear?
Yes, there certainly was. Well, the moment that we emerged back out onto the street after our visit, the cars were rushing by. There were people laughing, talking, doing normal things in life. And there was a moment for me of almost wanting to scream, my world has stopped. I want the world to stop as well. And I had to realise that day that the world would not stop. My experience would go on irrespective of what was happening around. Fear is an initial response. There is a degree of numbness that encapsulates us, which I guess is a God-given way of dealing with the awful shocks of life that we get. And that shock and numbness can sometimes make it hard to feel God's presence. And therefore, I think that sometimes we need to be aware of that. Even Christians will have their moments where they do feel abandoned and do feel alone. And the great essential questions of suffering, where is God in this? God is good and God is all powerful. Why this? But God has in his Son suffered for us and with us.
Alwyn, do you remember moments with your family like that, and whenever your dad said, look, I've now had what effectively is a terminal diagnosis, of a family trying to deal with that, accept that, wanting to fight that, because people often will say, I'm fighting, I wouldn't have decided to fight it. What did you go through?
I think reflecting back in initial diagnosis, I remember actually just the distress of associating cancer with a loved one. To even name your dad at the same time as name cancer was just so distressing. So that initial diagnosis, I think for families, as I remember it, was just very distressing. And then as you get diagnosis along the journey and as you have scans and treatments and all of that, there's a lot of processing that you do as you receive that information. And of course, as Christians, we bring it to God and we need his help in processing that. We pray for God's touch and healing, pray for treatment to work. We have those longings for the person, but also I think recognizing that there's life to be lived, that life doesn't just stop. And I remember the time actually of my dad's terminal diagnosis was a really significant time in my life, and that I was making decisions about leaving my job and moving to London and going back to full-time study. And I did all of that in the 6 years that Dad had a terminal diagnosis, and he wanted that for me, and I believe that that's what God was leading me to. So I think sometimes we hear the word terminal and we think that's it, whereas actually there's a lot of life to be lived, and even right up to the final moments, there's life to be lived. And so in all of our weakness and brokenness and how we do that, we need to grasp the life that has to be lived. And I would say in those 6.5 years as a family, we had birthdays, graduations, a family wedding. My dad had grandchildren that were born. We enjoyed holidays, concerts. Of course, we wept buckets of tears. We had conversations about the future. My parents planned for the future. They thought really specifically about even where Dad would go home to heaven from. So they moved to Port Stewart. And so he spent his last days in Port Stewart. And so there was a lot of life lived in those years.
When people are ill and people are on the journey with them, they use two words and they always put "and" between them, and they say pain and suffering. Suffering and pain and suffering. And they're connected in, but they're not necessarily the same thing, are they?
I have measured and thought and struggled and prayed a lot to make sense. Part of the consequence of my surgery was that I am left with pretty much chronic pain. Pain is an experience that is real. We've all felt it from the time we've stubbed our toe on the door. It's a real experience where our body signals in our mind that there is something wrong. But if pain becomes chronic, it can often master us and control us. Research has shown that hopelessness or having no meaning can make the experience of pain worse.
Really?
That has been well attested in science. My own reflection and study is that pain and suffering are different things. That if I can put it this way, pain is the picture, but suffering is the frame that we put it in. And a picture changes greatly when we adjust the frame, as we know. Pain isn't here to destroy me in my faith perspective. And knowing the Lord is with me, knowing his grace and his love and the hope of heaven, through all that has happened, that God is there and God cares and God understands, and indeed that God has a purpose. I love Johnny Erickson Tada, the lifelong quadriplegic's words: God permits what he hates to accomplish what he loves. And this is not because God hates me, but because of God's love, he is working in my life, in some ways using me to help others. I love the analogy of the difference between iron and steel, that iron is actually harder than steel, contrary to many people's understanding. But steel, combination of iron and carbon together, creates something that is malleable, something that can bend, something that reflects and become its old shape again. And I feel that I've come to find that I and God can handle this pain, that he has become the frame in which my pain exists now and until that great day when there will be no more tears and no more suffering and no more pain.
Owen, both of you, actually, Ian as well, have spent a lot of time sitting with people who've been ill when you have no doubt had your operations in. People sat with you. You learned a lot that I suspect a lot of us could learn from, about how to sit with someone, how to spend time with someone. What just not to say? What just never to say? What have you learned?
I think when it comes to how we process and sit and care for people, I'm struck by a phrase that Eugene Peterson used where he talked about the pastoral work of pain sharing, or even sharing in suffering. That actually, that doesn't mean that we minimize suffering or avoid it, and even that we're not particularly interested in finding an explanation for it, that we are just sharing it. We need courage to be able to be in that space with one another. And to do that, I think we need to learn that we're actually created to be deeply interdependent, not independent as our culture would form us to be.
Very much the modern way, isn't it?
Yeah, that actually our lives are entwined with one another. And so we need to learn how to love each other really well and lead each other gently to Jesus in that as we share each other's pain. So again, I think everybody's story is so unique. Everybody's diagnosis is unique. If it's cancer, everybody's cancer is unique. And therefore we need to listen really well to the story and the person that is there, to find out about them and their own experience of suffering. And it's not always about big, long conversations. It can be about presence. It can be about simple gestures to show that you care and that they're not alone. Mm-hmm. We found that as a family, words were not always the thing that mattered the most. It was the simple gestures that showed that people cared. And I think sometimes we can use words in ways that, you know, people would say, I must come and visit you, and never did. You know, and I think we need to be really careful about the words that we use, the things that we say. If we're going to say them, let's mean them, and let's actually show genuine Christian love and empathy as we journey with one another in that. Mm. I was thinking that even as we culturally, as we are perhaps entering a new landscape of how we're thinking about the end of life, but also how as Christians do we covenant to love one another really well, right from the beginning of life to the very end of life. One of the really profound experiences for me in Dad's final days in the Macmillan unit was one of my sisters was heavily pregnant at the time. The day before Dad died, she was having a scan, and I went with her to that scan and to listen to the heartbeat of my nephew, and then to realize at the other part of the hospital that Dad was dying. Just even that recognition of love at the beginning of life and love at the end of life, and also that God gives and that God takes away.
But I'll bet that little heartbeat will have mattered to your dad.
It did matter to Dad. Yes, it did. And Dad wasn't sure whether he would ever meet his grandson, and he didn't. But he knew that, yes, as we all did, that life would be precious and matter. And And he's been such a blessing in our family.
In that talk Douglas gave, Ian, he said a lot of things that really struck me when I listened to it, but he said, you know, there are phrases that I just don't understand, like battling an illness, battling cancer, fighting it, putting up with it, soling it, and other expressions that people would, it seems amazing, but they would do it. They would say, what did you do? What sin did you commit for this to happen to you? Or even one person telling him he'd been cursed. You hear that, don't you? And you must roll your eyes.
Undoubtedly, there are so many. I think there are two responses that are common from people. One is, I don't know what to say, so I don't say anything. The other response is, I feel I have to say something, and usually that is unhelpful. Things like be strong, stay positive, God won't give you more than you can handle is one of the ones that I find most irritating. Experience does not bear that out. One of my wonderful go-to verses is Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 15. And I sat where they sat. The Jewish captives who were in the lowest experience imaginable, I sat where they sat. I just wish that I can do that. I could do that better. And I loved it when people did better. I don't know what to say. This must be very hard for you. I'm here for you. How are you feeling today? Can I pray for you? Or how can I pray for you? I find it even as well received and accepted by people who are not believers or who may not share any faith. Or best, can I do shopping for you? Can I do the laundry? Could I collect the kids, or can I drive you to chemo?
Our last episode was all about palliative care and about looking after people and what it is and what it isn't. And Max and Matt helped us understand that, and it was fascinating. But one of the things they said was you get really important, high quality when it's done right, medical care. But that can't be everything, because people have emotional needs, they have spiritual needs, they have, and we get them even when we aren't ill, black moments in the middle of the night. How important is it to get that balance right, Ian, from your experience? Because you've sat with so many people, but you've also woken up knowing you're ill.
Yes.
And know all about it.
Yes, indeed. Well, I think that in that experience of being ill and ministering to those who are ill, I found one thing first off is that it has removed all the need for me to explain myself for being there or having to try and work my way into another person's experience. Though I will never say that, and one thing I am conscious in advising others, please don't say I understand what you're going through. My story will never be your story. And I find in all of that experience, the wonder of our health service and knowing that in palliative care, I will be cared for. I won't forget my recovery in ICU and being introduced to the wonder of the syringe driver and morphine and being gently chided to use this sparingly.
Yes, less.
Yes. But I think it's wonderful to know that our health service is there, and we would want all of us who have had experience of that to commend the amazing care and the amazing kindness that has been, is and will be shown to us in our times of pain and suffering. I feel that as someone ministering daily to people with cancer, one of the interesting feedbacks I have now, perhaps Northern Ireland is somewhat different from other parts of the world or the United Kingdom, in that faith perspectives, while they may not be present generation, what has come from the past still lingers in people's hearts and minds. And I have not come across calls with any degree of regularity for folk who wanted to escape the end of the journey in any way. But there is still an understanding largely that we will be cared for through that. I guess that probably from a faith perspective, there is the understanding that my life is not my own. And that is essential, I think. And again, perspectives change, that if in our more secular worldview, if we don't see that as if we don't see our lives as being a trust given to us by God, then things will change. But I still find a lot of that around where people don't share faith. They still have that sense that my life isn't mine.
It sounds like everybody understands that there is an emotional and spiritual part to my well-being, even if I'm living with a terminal diagnosis, as well as the very important medical side of it. Yes. Both matter, clearly.
Both matter. Very much so. In a very real sense, I see this as being very important, that we see the person holistically as we care for them in their need. And the role of the minister, the role of the counsellor, the role of the chaplain, that all has to be, if you excuse the pun, rolled up together with the medical staff, because we are whole people, and the spiritual part of that must be taken into account. If I can be forgiven, because I know the person concerned would have no difficulty in me sharing, someone who, after a life of unbelief, when in hospice, asked for me to attend and to come and see her. I found her initially very well medically attended to, but in deep trouble of mind and of spirit. And we spent long hours, literally, sharing together. For me, first listening, and then I quietly had the privilege of sharing my faith, my hope, my peace, my comfort. And it was an immense moment of joy when I returned to the hospice to find that the dear lady with whom I had come to share many happy hours of conversation told me that she had come to personal faith. And the sheer evidence of joy in her face, the sense of peace that had encompassed her life, was commented on by the staff who were caring for her. She went to her eternal reward 2 days after. After she had told me of her coming to faith, she asked me, "Will you conduct my funeral?" Which was a glorious opportunity to share with many who had no faith perspective in life the truth of the gospel, the hope of the gospel, and the reality of God's wonderful mercy to someone who had spent their whole life rejecting him.
There comes a time to all of us when this life ends. And there was the day your dad departed this life, Olwen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he went to his eternal reward.
Mm-hmm.
But then you live on in this life without him.
Mm-hmm.
As did the whole of your family. And you grieve. And people say often you get used to grieving, but you don't really ever stop. Would that be your experience?
I think when you are living with somebody with a terminal diagnosis, I think there's lots of moments I've found of grief. There's grief at the diagnosis. There's grief as you see somebody losing the ability to live perhaps the full life physically that they had done. I think for me, a particular moment of grief was accepting when Dad was dying, which was in the last couple of months of his life. I came home from London for a holiday, and I remember that he could no longer go out for walks as he would have done. He didn't have an appetite. Dad loved his food. He no longer could enjoy his food the way he did. He loved to read. He could no longer concentrate on reading. And there were indications that he was dying. And I think what was really important was for us as a family to transition to accept that he was dying. I think the danger is that we live in denial, that God will heal him or he will be restored to health or the treatment will work. Whereas actually we need to come, I believe, to a point of accepting that a loved one is dying so that we can accompany them in those final days. And that for me was incredibly difficult to do that. But it allowed me to express to him my desire to be with him and to accompany him in those final days. And so in those final months, I remember going back to London and then the final days coming back again and just having the privilege of being with him when he died. Those final days in the hospice were just really precious. So I think in accepting that somebody is dying, recognizing that actually what you're doing is helping them to transition to their life eternal. And Dad often used the phrase that he wasn't terminally ill, he was transitionally ill, and that actually what he was doing was journeying towards his eternal home. That's very painful and difficult, but it's such a privilege to have done that and to do that. And somebody gave me the picture of grief once, which I find particularly helpful. They said grief is sometimes feels like a lion that's going to devour you, and sometimes it feels like a cat that's purring on your lap. And so the burden of grief can be sometimes feel overwhelming, and other times it's just a gentle missing. I think nearly 9 years later, I would say most of the grief is just that gentle missing that you miss Dad. We were together as a family at the weekend. You know, you miss Dad on those occasions. At significant family events, you miss him. You miss him for his, he had a great sense of humour. I miss his banter. Again, just all of the things, all of the ways that he was part of your life, you miss. And so I think it's important that we recognise that grief is not something that we get over our past. Life builds around our grief. We need to relearn how to live life without that person in it. And as we do that, there's richness in life. I think what the journey of grief teaches me and has taught me is that when you look death in the face, actually you appreciate the value and gift of life. And having felt the depth of distress at Dad's illness and death, actually it's increased my capacity to feel and to appreciate life and to appreciate the gift of other people and all of the good things that God has given us and the beauty of creation and the gift of this life, and that as we have breath, we have the opportunity to live and to live life and to live life as well as we can. And grief, I believe, has taught me that.
We've been having this conversation today because societies around us are contemplating, voting on, arguing, debating legislation that would allow people to finish their lives early and involve medical professionals in certain circumstances. In that, when you sit with people, Ian, when you spend time with them and listen, and they're fortunate with you because in many cases what they're talking about, you do actually understand a lot of what they're talking about. Do you hear people often say, I want to end my life early. I wish I could make the decision to make it happen now and not continue with all these things I clearly don't want to live with. What do you hear?
Well, to be honest, in the normal routine of visiting people, I go to see people who are very much at the terminal stage of their illness. I'm not hearing overwhelmingly at all the calls for assisted dying, assisted suicide is not something that is high on the majority of people's list of priorities here. Personally, I my own understanding and viewing of it and my concern would be with the present debate is that, as I call it, the slippery slope of the could I, would I, should I? And as we're currently standing at the point of the gate in the debate, it's the could I, but that could I is not a gate that has opened. Once we open that gate, it becomes the dilemma of would I? And that's a new dilemma for the individual. Dying versus living the best all the days of my life. And that creates a dilemma for me, for the person, that the person is not then seeking to live the best. And I have come across many folk who are terribly ill, but who have fully and richly enjoyed their lives until the moment that God has taken them away. But the dilemma goes on then, should I? The could I, would I, and should I? The pressure then that may be put on by others. You're a burden. The pressure of society to explain the costs, perhaps, of palliative care, or indeed the pressure of maybe would-be inheritors who may also add to the list of those who would put the pressure on to advocate the should I. And therefore, my contention would be that we do not get beyond the could I on the slippery slope.
Well, when I'm going to finish with something your dad and mum knew about and quoted, which is what Kay Warren said.
Kay Warren had her own journey with cancer, defined joy as this, and it was something that mum and dad found particularly precious. And she said this: joy is the settled assurance that God is in control of all the details of my life, the quiet confidence that ultimately everything is going to be all right, and the determined choice to praise him in all things. And in that, what she was expressing was that joy is not dependent on our circumstances, but has everything to do with what we believe about God, the Spirit's work in our lives, and our response to it.
Olwen, Ian, thank you so much, both of you, for taking the time to speak to us today, for being so candid, for being so honest and so clear and so brave, because these are not easy things. We do appreciate it. Thank you very much indeed. Don't forget, the Presbyterian Church in Ireland website has a resource hub on assisted dying and euthanasia. It's called Living and Dying Well. It's a great resource to help you think about all this stuff. And you can see who's written what, the points they make. It's called Living and Dying Well. And thank you to you for listening. The next part of this series answers some questions for you, very specific ones. What's my part in all of this? How do I pray? How do I support the church's point of view and make sure the rest of civic society hears it and understands it? How do I help the charities and organisations that actually provide the better way, the palliative care way that we've discussed, providing the best possible palliative care? Could I raise funds? Could I volunteer? You'll be able to find that where you found this episode. Do join us again for that. And in the meantime, bye-bye.